Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us on this journal club that's delayed from last week. I appreciate those of you who are joining us today, and I'm sorry to those of you who I had to reschedule and you're not able to join us, but perhaps listening later. So these are the October 2023 articles. I identified 12 original articles and two case reports that I felt served the purposes of this journal club. As is convention, we selected four of those for presentation today. And Heather, thank you to her for taking on the work of selecting and presenting two of them. She'll present first, after I kind of go over a couple articles for notation that I just want to point out here. Scroll down here. Under the articles for notation, there's an article in Modern Pathology and one in Pathology International that both are putting into focus macrophages. You know, the attention has shifted this month at least from lymphocytes to more what's going on with intratumoral and tumor-associated macrophages, and do those have any prognostic significance? In both reports, macrophages in neuroendocrine carcinomas were found to be associated with poor prognosis. Based on these articles, I don't anticipate that anything's going to change with the work that we have to do, but it's something to be aware of. For those of you that perform autopsies, there was an autopsy article. It's the lone non-neoplastic article that it was out of India, entitled "New Autopsy Technique in COVID-19 Positive Dead Bodies or Decedents, Opening the Thoracic Cavity with an Outlook to Reduce Aerosol Spread." And so this is just describes and details an approach with pictures that we're entering the thoracic cavity through the diaphragm. So if you do autopsies, maybe this is of interest to you. I think that an article out of Houston Methodist was interesting to me, and maybe one of the most interesting, I suppose, because I like articles that make me think about what I could be missing or misdiagnosing. This was titled "Desmoplastic Small Round Cell Tumor Involving Serous Fluids, Cytologic Features, and Diagnostic Pitfalls in a Series of Eight Cases." Really, this group looked at five pleural fluids and four acidic fluids in patients who were known to have desmoplastic small round cell tumor, but they wanted to detail these findings to highlight potential pitfalls, diagnostic pitfalls, should the diagnosis not already be known or expected. They found that a good number of cases mimic the appearance of metastatic carcinomas or mesotheliomas. Perhaps a diagnostic pitfall, further compounded by the fact that these tumors can be keratin positive and positive for MOC31 and Claudin-4. So just wanted to mention it here to bring it into your awareness, because that's why I appreciated this article, just reminding me of where I can screw up. So I'm going to turn the presentation over to Heather for the presentation of the first two articles. Heather, I think you're going to share your screen. Is that
Yeah,
correct?
yes,
All
I
right,
am.
go
All
ahead.
right. So I think you need to stop sharing and then
Oh,
I'll
sorry
share.
about
Oh,
that.
yeah, no worries. Okay, sounds good. Let me get this. Okay, great. All right, everyone. Hi, I'm Heather. I am the thoracic fellow this year at Michigan. So I'll be presenting two of the articles. The first one is a article from Japan. It's titled "A Problem with Clinical T Factor in the Eighth TNM Edition: Prognosis and EGFR Mutation Status of Small-sized Lung Cancers with Difficulty to Measure the Diameter of Solid Component in Part Solid Tumor." So essentially, they're looking at the eighth TNM stage and what they call part solid tumors, which is essentially like tumors with invasive and lipidic growth. So that's what they're referring to when they mention part solid. And they want to like see how these like tumors fit in terms of prognosis and biologic behavior and see like how these should be staged in general. They had a 2013 paper that they mentioned, and that mentioned that like the size of these tumors are can be difficult to measure because it can be like scattered, it could be discontinuous. So how do we measure these tumors, Do we do it? So what they ended up doing is they looked at almost 600 patients with at least like CT1 stage 1A non-small cell lung cancer. So anything between like MI to like T1C. And they had they excluded lungs with emphysema just because like it was difficult to measure the extent of, I guess, the CT scan. So they looked at these tumors, and they looked at the CT scans, and they evaluated the maximum tumor dimension based on the CT scans, the maximum dimension of consolidation, and distribution of ground glass opacities. And then they ended up classifying tumors based off radiologic types. So there were three types that they mentioned, which were island, reticular, and dense. So islands were basically like where they saw different di islands of consolidation. Reticular was more mesh-like, and then dense was like a density between ground glass opacities and consolidation. And then they ended up reclassifying those tumors based off the eighth edition. They looked at a couple of other clinical pathologic findings, such as like the especially overall survival and cancer-specific survival, and the EGFR mutation status. So what they ended up finding is they had like a distribution of lung cancers in all different stages, and they had about 79 of them that were considered this like part solid tumor, or what they also name as lung cancers with scattered or mixed consolidation, LC-SMC. So what they ended up doing, and I'll just switch over to the PDF file here, which has the tables. Is they like got these characteristics and then saw based on these tables, like where do these like LC SMCs fit in relation to like the data found in these other tumor types, basically. So what they s noted was that, like, for example, the median maximum tumor size on CT scan like was placed between CT1B and CT1A, essentially. Like their average was like similar in between the averages for maximum tumor size between T1A and T1B. And then like the ratio of lobectomy for these LC-SMCs was in between T1A and T1B. They also looked at frequency of lymphatic invasion and vascular invasion, and they found that frequency was between the frequencies found in T1A and T1B. Or T1MI and T1A. They did not observe stats in these tumors. So then they also looked at prognosis here. And then I think, like, let's see, where is the prognosis? I don't think it's in this. It's in these tables here. And like where the LC-SMCs were placed was closer to be like the prognosis in between T1A, T1B. And then the cancer-specific survival for these LC-SMCs was in between CT1MI and CT1A. So in that case, I think they concluded based on like these like averages and like where these fell in between that like these tumors should be classified as closer to T1As just based on their biologic behavior, also their prognostic behavior too. They also looked at EGFR status compared to the other tumors, and the incidence of EGFR mutations was about 54%. They did not find a significant difference in between the frequency of EGFR mutations for these LC-SMC tumors and these CT1As, but they did find that there was a higher incidence of EGFR mutations between these LC-SMCs and also CT1Bs. So I guess based on that conclusion, because there's no significant difference in the frequency, based on the EGFR mutation status frequency, they concluded that like that biologic behavior should be similar to CT1A. So I guess like in their overall conclusion based off this study is that in these like part solid tumors where it is like kind of hard to measure the width of the tumor, you should classify these possibly as PT1As. So that's pretty much like the gist of this summary. They also did mention a little bit about the like different CT findings too. I don't think they really went into as much detail as to like, you know, what does this mean for the tumors, but just to kind of chat about it a little bit, they showed us some examples of these like three different types of like CT findings we can see in these like part solid or LC-SMCs. So the first one is this like scattered type, and then this is that mixed consolidation or reticular type, and then this is more of the dense type. And then they showed images where this kind of correlates with like the histologic finding. So this reticular type, this has like a more lipidic growth pattern, whereas this island type has like a discontinuous focus. But so that's it for this paper. Does anyone have any questions or comments for this?
Thanks, Heather. So was their recommendation then more staging cases based off the radiology and the mutation status? Is that what their overall conclusions are, that those should be taken more into account than the
Yeah,
pathology?
that was my understanding based off this paper. It was, yeah, I think that like based on like the size that they measured on radiology and like the other histologic, they should, that's what they're basing off their recommendation how to stage these tumors and the EGFR status. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
All right, otherwise, we will move on to the second paper I will talk about. And this is a paper from Hungary. It's titled Proposal of a Grading System for Squamous Cell Carcinoma of the Lung, the Prognostic Importance of Tumor Budding, Single Cell Invasion, and Nuclear Diameter. This was in the Virchow Archives. And so the purpose of this paper was to propose a new grading system for lung squamous cell carcinoma, and they wanted to use three different parameters, and they were tumor budding, nuclear diameter, and single cell invasions. They do acknowledge that there are some other proposed systems. So there's one by Kadota and others, and they essentially grade squamous cell carcinomas by tumor budding and nuclear diameter. And then Weicher et al., they wanted to grade squamous cell carcinomas based off of tumor budding and nest size. So this group, they looked at the squamous cell carcinomas within a given time frame, and they measured a couple of clinical parameters, you know, including follow-up survival and whatnot. And then they looked at the H&E stage sections from of these squamous cell carcinomas, and they were blinded to clinical outcome. So the pathologist recorded the tumor size, distance to resection margin, the presence of spread through aerospaces, and then the number of mitoses. So they counted for 10 high-powered fields, and if it was below 15, it was considered a low mitotic count, and if it was above 15, it was considered a high mitotic count. They also wanted to characterize the nature of the invasive front, so whether it was like expansile versus like infiltrative, and they wanted to know if there was any vascular, lymphovascular pole invasion. And then based off what I had mentioned in the introduction, they proposed a three-tier grading scheme, and that was the extent of tumor budding, the presence of single cell invasion, and nuclear diameter. And just to kind of like talk about each parameter. So tumor budding, it was essentially like they defined it like I think similar to like tumor budding, maybe like say colonic cancer, where we see isolated small tumor nets of like less than 5 cells that are like away from the invasive tumor front and that was surrounded by desmoplastic stromal. So that's how they defined tumor budding. And then they wanted to see the total number of beds on 10 MPFs, basically. And so they wanted to measure also the maximum number of buds in one hotspot. So then they tiered each like number essentially for low, medium to high. So if you had no tumor budding, that was considered low. Anywhere between 1 to 14 was considered medium. Anything above 15 was considered high. And then they measured the minimal cell nest size. So I think in one of the other grading systems, they wanted to include nest size as part of the grading. So, but in this instance, they essentially considered single cell invasion only. So by cell nest size, it was essentially the smallest tumor cluster within the tumor invasive front, subclassified according to cell number. So if there was like a cell nest that was only like single cell invasion, that was just called single cell invasion. And then a small nest was anywhere between 2 to 4 tumor cells. An intermediate nest was anywhere between 5 to 14 tumor cells. And a large nest was anywhere above 15 tumor cells. So that was considered when they were looking at like cell nest size. And then the last thing they looked at was the nuclear diameter, and that was compared to lymphocytes. So if a nucleus was less than 4 lymphocytes, that was considered small. And if it was greater than 4 lymphocytes, it was considered large. So the three components. And then they did include a table that sort of highlights what I just said in a more elegant way instead of me just reading out everything. So here is that tumor table. And then based on the scores, essentially, you got a grade that was either low, intermediate, or high. So yeah, the number of tumor buds, presence of single cell invasion, there or not, and the nuclear diameter, and then low, medium, intermediate, or high. So what they ended up doing was they had about 220 total of squamous cell carcinomas. And they found that like certain characteristics they were looking for were associated with certain parameter certain things. So for tumor budding, it was associated with smoking history and a higher stage. So it might have been a significant prognostic marker, and it was more often found in keratinizing histologic subtypes. It was also associated with an infiltrative tumor border, smaller minimal cell nest size, single cell invasion, larger nuclear diameter, and invasion. So overall, I think like their conclusion was that tumor budding does like the presence and the amount of it like does correlate well with more adverse signs. Single cell invasion. So they found that this was more frequent in patients with a higher nodal status and a higher stage, and also associated with the infiltrative tumor border, smaller minimal cell nest size categories, and lymphovascular invasion. And then the larger nuclear diameter was more frequent in smaller minimal cell nest size categories. And then they, based on like the three grading systems, so like the one that they're proposing, the Kodota and the Weichert grading system, they found that their grading system had the highest AUC value in ROC curve analysis. And compared to the other two grading systems, they were better able to separate the tumors into three prognostic categories. So that was like kind of their conclusion. They looked at stats, but it was a pretty rare event. But like when they did find it, apparently it was associated with a poor prognosis, independent of all the other factors. So the take-home message here essentially is that their grading system, based off the tumor budding, amount, the presence or absence of single cell invasion and nuclear diameter, seems to correlate well with prognosis, and you can put that in like a three-tier grading system. So, yeah. Does anyone have any questions about this paper?
Heather, I think you may have said it, but did they control for TNN stage in these? Like, are these truly prognostic factors, or are they just, do they correlate with, I think you had mentioned T stage, or are they independent prognostic factors?
I don't think they correlated with T stage. I think they only correlated with nodal status in this case, though. So I don't think they controlled in this case. So like looking, let's see, let's look at the table. Yeah, and I think even in this table, they don't really mention the nodal status, but they do mention it in the discussion. Let's
Yeah.
see. Yeah, so I guess they did look at the T stage, but I don't feel like they ended up controlling for it.
Yeah. So T stage is still important. All right. Anything else? My turn.
Yeah. Okay, I'll stop sharing.
All right. I picked an article from Histopathology that comes out of the group is largely out of Germany, And I thought this was interesting. This group wanted to identify and validate markers that might help in differentiating type A and type B3 thymomas. This is admittedly something that hasn't really been on my radar, I guess, but maybe I have not been so aware of the spindly type of B3 and kind of the diagnostic pitfall, if you will, I suppose, of confusing type A thymoma and type B3 thymomas. I'll just show you quickly kind of what they're referring to here. This is a picture of kind of the spindly type of type B3 thymoma that, to my eye, certainly overlaps with type A thymomas. So what this group set out to do is to identify candidate proteins by gel electrophoresis followed by mass spectrometry. They were using a screening set of snap frozen samples of type A thymoma and type B3 thymoma. And just important to note that for all thymomas used in this study, WHO classification was based upon H&E diagnosis. So that was ultimately what was king here. They then, from these kind of candidate proteins, identified antibodies for, or at least kind of a set of antibodies that they would use to apply to a pilot set of 10 type A thymomas and 10 type B3 thymomas. And then, based on those findings, they would further trim that list and apply those antibodies to a validation set of blocks that comprised 88 formalin fixed. Paraffin-embedded tissue samples that are enriched for type A and type B3 thymomas. You can see all the numbers here. Kind of a very minor component of this study was they looked at immunofluorescence using dual stains to confirm that the staining of cell types were epithelial based on kind of what they were interpreting based on the H&E and the immunohistochemistry. So what they found from their mass spec was they identified 49 proteins that were differentially expressed between type A and type B3 thymomas. And from these, they found eight potentially useful markers. Those are listed on page 610 if you want to look at those in detail. So they selected those and applied those to the pilot set. So those 10 type A thymomas and 10 type B3 thymomas. And of those eight, they only found that SAT-B1 and ASS1 were sufficiently discriminatory to be applied to the validation set. So table one details the stain patterns for all tumors tested, but since this kind of the focus of this paper was type A and type B3 thymomas, I just summarized those results in this little table I created here. That is really what I wanted to know. So ASS1 is a cytoplasmic stain, and 100% of type A thymomas were negative, whereas 100% of type B3 thymomas were positive. So the sensitivity and specificity of ASS1 was 100%. SAT-B1, a nuclear stain, was positive in 92% of the type A thymomas and 95% of the type B3 thymomas, it was negative. So the sensitivity for SAT-B1 was 91% and the specificity was 95%. And when you use these markers in combination, the sensitivity and specificity for discriminating type A and type B3 thymomas was 94 and 98%, respectively. So there were, I want to show you kind of was interested in looking at, was there anything that stood out on those that didn't stain as expected? And nothing stood out to me. The authors didn't go into that terribly in any detail, but in those cases, it doesn't appear that they were misclassified. There were no clues, at least from this, that they were misclassified based on their H&E. Those that were type A and were negative for SAT-B1, as you would expect that you would want them to be positive or expect them to be positive. They were also negative for ASS1, so it wasn't a scenario in which the ASS1 was positive, this was negative, and you wondered, is this really a spindly type B3 thymoma? For the one type B3 thymoma that was positive for SAPB1, it was also positive for ASS1. So there's just a subset, it looks like, of that are not going to stain as anticipated for SAPB1, but ASS1 does have that 100% specificity and sensitivity, at least in this setting. Certainly, here you can look at the different types. This was not a main focus of the paper, and I think that overall, there isn't, if you're going to have a lymphocyte-rich thymoma, this really isn't part of the differential here. But so they didn't focus on this really in much detail, although there's a flow chart if you want to look at it. So let's see. The take-home message here is you might consider applying ASS1 and SAPB1 immunohistochemical stains when trying to differentiate between type A thymoma and type B3 thymoma with spindle morphology, particularly on small biopsies. And I don't know here, is this a common problem that people encounter and I'm just not recognizing it? I just don't know, before you run to add these, how much of a problem is this? I don't think Anya's on the call here. I think she was going to be away. She was available last week, but not this week. Anyone?
I guess I didn't know this was much of a problem, which probably means I've been screwing up some diagnoses.
That's how I felt. That's how I felt. So, and it was unclear to me too, at least from our standpoint, is how would this change anything in kind of a pre-surgical setting? But anyways, so something to learn more about or be aware of again, I suppose. And there are some antibodies out there if this really becomes a problem in the future. Moving on, our last article is from the IASLC. It's a study on the reproducibility in the assessment of pathologic response in resected lung cancers after neoadjuvant therapy. Anya was on an author on this article. I don't know if anyone else in the group was. Her name just stood out to me. But at any rate, let's move forward. So the purpose, as the title implies, is the assessment of the reproducibility of the histologic criteria for pathologic response, or PR, as they kind of refer to it throughout their paper, in resected non-small cell lung cancers treated with neoadjuvant immunotherapy plus or minus chemotherapy. And this is among thoracic pathologists around the globe. So there have been prior studies that kind of have asked this question, but those are really single institution studies. This one differed in there kind of being people with all different approaches across the globe. No outcome data was looked at here, simply because their goal was looking at how well the reproducibility was. So the methods, they looked at tumor bed slides from six different clinical trials that they amassed, all representing non-small cell lung cancers resected from patients who received either anti-PD-L1 therapy, anti-CLTA4 therapy, or anti-PD-L1 therapy plus chemotherapy. And their exclusion criteria was simply synchronous multiple tumor nodules. And they only looked at the tumor bed slides. They weren't looking at nodes or anything like that. So the H&E slides were digitized and reviewed by two groups of pathologists, 11 pathologists total, a group of five and a group of six, who were blinded to all data. So all pathologists who participated underwent three online training modules. The first was online training modules that included kind of a review of the scoring criteria, so making sure that everyone kind of was on the same page about what they should be scoring. Then they also had a training module on this web-based calculator that they developed and used. And the training used 30 imaged slides that were different. So the training set was different from the study set. And They did the 30 image slides, and then there was post-training discussion for discordant cases. So where are areas that presented pitfalls for them? When they reviewed the digitized slides, they then entered data into this major pathologic response calculator. I don't know if anyone has used one of these before. I'm kind of maybe most familiar with the breast one that MD Anderson has, but I know that there's a lot more out there. And this included tumor bed dimensions, percent viable tumor, and percent necrosis. Oh, this calculator I think was supported by MD Anderson. And there were pre-embedded formulas in this in the calculator that calculated weighted and unweighted averages of viable tumor on all slides. The weighted average being taking into account the variations in tumor proportions and tumor bed on each slide. And then the inter-observer reproducibility was based on these MPR scores. So 84 non-small cell lung cancer samples were reviewed that comprised a combination of mainly adenocarcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas. And the highest concordance was seen at the extremes of there's a lot of viable tumor or there's zero viable tumor, which you would hope and expect. Perhaps that these are the areas in which the pathologists agreed the most. And I think that figure two kind of illustrates all their findings here. I really like this one. There is a small typo, I think, here where the blue is unweighted and the red is weighted just down in the text here. It doesn't say unweighted for B. But nonetheless, you can see here kind of the concordance or becomes kind of the least concordance occurs when the viability is between 30 and 60%. It's kind of in this middle area, which you can see the nadir. And then throughout the weighted and unweighted averages, there was no difference. I mean, the red and the blue lines are basically on top of one another. So that was a take home. And so then they looked at a small group, not all 11 pathologists, but a smaller group looked at the 16 cases as having discordant interpretations. And it was unclear to me, I have to admit, how they flagged these cases as being major outliers, because it was maybe, just one, in some instances, one pathologist differed from the interpretation of the five others. So I don't know how far, this individual had to be as an outlier. But I think that looking at table one here, this provides, they broke it down in different categories, but I think the greatest pitfalls occur around tumor bed assessment and stromal inflammation. In particular, there were two cases where about 50% of the pathologists struggled in the setting of delineating the tumor bed. And really that occurred, they detail this down below, but in the settings of prominent apical cap or differentiating apical cap from tumor bed. And then when there's dense pleural fibrosis, such as pleural adhesions, they couldn't really tell on the digitized slides. They felt like in these scenarios, an elastic stain could have been helpful since they were only looking at H and E. Certainly there were more tools if they weren't doing this in kind of this digitized setting. But tumor bed assessment can be difficult and this, when there's a lot of stromal inflammation, that caused difficulties, at least for kind of a subset that I've pulled out here. Again, in the setting of inflammation and a prominent apical cap, and then when there's multifocal tumor, kind of measuring that was difficult, and in the setting of a lot of stromal inflammation. So those represent kind of the major difficulties in this being reproducible. So the authors concluded that that their criteria for assessing pathologic response in post-neoadjuvant lung cancers can be reliably applied by experts using an MPR calculator. And that's not eyeballing, as I suspect many of us do, or admittedly, I do, particularly when there's excellent or poor response to therapy. So at those two extremes that I talked about, and I would be interested to know if, here they're doing this in a very digitized way. If, I mean, eyeballing could potentially in these two extreme scenarios be just as good, but that wasn't a question that they were asking here. The delineation of the tumor bed and the setting of apical cap or pleural fibrosis and marked stromal inflammation represent the greatest potential problems in interpretation. I think that all of those conclusions made perfect sense to me in things that we struggle with just on the day-to-day. So I was curious here if anyone is using one of these calculators to just in their daily practice when they're encountering cases that have had neoadjuvant therapy. I know, as I've already admitted, I haven't used that. I use the eyeball method. But what is everyone else doing here? Anyone at
Christine, it
Mayo?
seems like, at least in the clinical trials I'm familiar with, you're only concerned about the extremes, right? And the fact that you don't have high rates of discordance in the middle is kind of irrelevant, right?
That's
I
how
mean,
I felt.
if you can agree on major pathologic response, that's the goal.
Yep, that was how I felt too. I thought that it didn't, it, where we were concordant, it was in the area that didn't really matter. When at Mayo using a calculator, or do you guys have a calculator available to you like this?
I think the only time we've used a calculator is for clinical trial enrollment. I've not used it clinically. We're just kind of eyeballing it clinically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Makes sense. All right. Well, that's all I have. And thank you, Heather, for your participation today. And thank you for everyone tuning in a week late. I appreciate your time.
Just quick question. Did they
Yeah.
have any suggestions or how they did handle these cases where there's a lot of apical cap type of fibrosis? Because it's not really well handled, I think, or in this.
They didn't really make any suggestions. They just acknowledged where that was a difficulty, and because and they did reinforce in their discussion that they were only looking at H&E slides and maybe, you know, other tools had they had an elastic stain that might have helped them. Also, any information about kind of the gross and that sort of thing they were blinded to. So they felt like if they had more information, maybe that wouldn't have been such a struggle. But I agree with you.
I mean, I was just curious if everybody is just including that, not overthinking that and including that in their percentage of fibrosis, or are you in clinical practice trying to separate that out? Because I got into a situation where, I was trying to think through it and try to separate that out, and then someone else was saying, "Oh no, you just include that and move on with your day."
I think the recommendation is to not include it. You know, reading their criteria, that you wouldn't include that, and that was part of what they were trying to separate out and why they were struggling. So, at least from what I understand, this growing criteria should not include apical cap. I have to admit, I haven't seen a ton of post-neoadjuvant cases. Yeah, just in general, coming through Michigan, see some, but not a ton. So, anyhow. All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thank
Thanks a
you.
lot.
Yeah, thanks
Bye.
everyone.
Thank
Bye.
you.
Have a good rest of the day.